and welcome to another episode of Events Deconstructed on the CGAI Podcast Network. I'm your host, the Vice President of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute, Dave Perry. On today's show, which we're recording June 19th, 2020, we're going to be talking with our fellow Roger Hilton, who wrote a primer about the NATO ministerial, which took place from June 18th to 19th, and was the first NATO meeting since the pandemic that wasn't strictly about the COVID-19 response. Roger is primarily a defense and security fellow at GlobeSec, an international think tank based in Bratislava, Slovakia. Roger, welcome to Defense Deconstructed.
Hi, Dave. Thanks for having me.
So appreciate you joining us on the phone down the highway in Montreal, and I hope you're well there. One of the things that is still happening internationally that doesn't necessarily get a lot of oxygen given the current focus on COVID and the response is NATO's business. And this week there was a couple of high-level meetings, and you were kind enough to write a quick primer for us ahead of those meetings. So why don't you just set up the conversation by talking a little bit about what the meetings were this week and the context in which they've happened with the recent other types of discussions that have been happening at NATO at a high level.
Yeah, well, Dave, you couldn't have said it better about a lot of NATO's businesses not making the front pages. For everybody out there listening, I think everybody agrees that what has been confirmed by all of this is that COVID, it doesn't kill geopolitics. So it's great that NATO is getting back to these bread and butter security issues. So just to set the platform for everybody, in April, the last ministerial, which was again held by video conference, NATO defense ministers spoke about resiliency, about sort of military procurement when it came to health issues, where organs like the Euro-Atlantic Disaster Response Coordination Center and NATO Support and Procurement Agency were really center stage about how NATO is helping to stem the spread of the virus and how allies are helping each other. So obviously, since the pandemic hit, I think all of the ministers on both sides of the Atlantic have been unbelievably busy. So it's definitely a change of pace to get back to those, you know, traditional security issues when they spoke earlier in the week. I really don't envy the defense ministers having to sit. There's a lot on their plates. I said very quickly in the primer, you have the flare-ups between China and India. There's military intimidation going on with Taiwan, not to mention a lot of other issues on the southern flank with what's going on in Africa, and as well, of course, in the eastern flank with Russia. So that's basically the overall setting about where we can go from there.
And I guess looking at it from a Canadian point of view, you've got kind of the continuation of the wider sort of set of policies and commitments and that type of thing as it was pre-COVID. You just have much different circumstances now where people aren't traveling, they're doing the VTCs. And you've seen some really kind of concrete examples of the way that it's required changes in approach with the example of the crews of our Navy ships before they're deploying having to go into an isolation period ahead of that. So that was a context in terms of the business of what NATO as an organization is focusing on. What came out of the discussions this week?
Yeah, I also just think it's important, Dave, to mention to everybody that your issue about sort of the new normal in terms of interaction, it's also a great exercise and practice for command and control, because also the start of the ministerial coincided with the end of BALTOPS, which was the 49th edition and the largest maritime exercise in the Baltic. So it was a great opportunity, again, for NATO and all of the participating allies, including Canada, to test out command and control capabilities, what work and what doesn't work. So I guess when you talk about the ministerial that happened, as I said, it was a bit of a dark cloud hanging over it. You had this very surprising U.S. announcement about withdrawal from Germany, which caught the chancellery off guard. But I think overall, the ministerial, they tried to stay away from it. Secretary General Stoltenberg was quite clear saying that just because those troops might be leaving Germany doesn't mean that all American troops are. And he made a specific point of pointing out how in Norway, for example, there's been more American troops than there's ever been. And as well, there's the American presence in Poland for the EFP. It's still a bit early to say, but a lot of the speculation suggests that the 9,500 troops might be going to Poland. And Andrzej Duda, the current president of Poland, was just invited on the 24th for a White House audience. So there could be another announcement looking out about the American troops just being relocated to Poland as opposed to Germany. But, you know, we also had
to jump in there. That would mean that, you know, so obviously that would have implications for the relationship between the United States and Germany and kind of the traditional American presence supporting NATO in Europe, because it's had a long history and all kinds of troops going back many, many years in Germany. But if there's a shift to another country and there's still an ongoing contribution, it doesn't necessarily, depending on what the actual shift looks like, it doesn't necessarily imply that there's going to be a reduced deterrent impact.
No, I mean, you couldn't have said it better. I mean, we're both, you know, as an amateur historian, how different the times of Germany and American relations are with Kennedy and General Clay in West Berlin. But like you said, I mean, I think it's more of a headache as opposed to a heartbreak with the troops moving, especially if they're just moving over to Poland, which will presumably irk the foreign policy policy and security apparatus in the Kremlin. But yeah, so just again, on some of the positive news that came out of it, Ukraine finally got enhanced cooperation partnership status, which was great. It really hasn't been making a lot of the news, but the OSCE special monitoring mission reports are still suggesting that the conflict is still going on with ceasefire violations. So it's good to see also from a Canadian perspective with Operation Unifier going on that Ukraine's able to sort of tap some of these other programs for deeper cooperation and security cooperation.
And then one of the things that came out of the press conference from the Secretary General was a discussion about what the alliance is going to do to basically get itself situated for a likely second wave of COVID. So what caught your eye in terms of those comments and what the alliance is thinking about in terms of just the ongoing pandemic response?
Yeah, listen, I mean, I think everybody, you know, across the world was caught a little bit flat-footed at first. And, you know, I think at the outset in Europe, whether it's the European Union, the initial reaction was a bit tribal. But, you know, slowly they found their footing, they found their rhythm. And it seems as if, you know, as I mentioned, these organizations earlier, they're going to be considerably more prepared about doing it. You know, there's a new operation plan in the works. They've been stockpiling health supplies and there's a new procurement plan. And most encouraging from a political and solidarity aspect is that the allies have pledged to donate surpluses of stockpiles that they have. So again, you know, they're going to be able to pick up the rhythm much quicker in the event that there's a second wave. And this is also very important because they're going to have to continue to do the normal deterrence and defense business in addition to the civil military cooperation when it comes to stemming the spread of the second wave.
And is it your sense that those efforts are oriented around the fact that there's some allies that are having more difficulty attaining that kind of equipment and being prepared? Or is it more about having common pools for common types of activities like at headquarters or on, you know, some of the actual the EFP missions, as an example, in the East? Do you figure it's a kind of a burden sharing and you know, some of those ideals about NATO's common partnerships and procurement initiatives to help different allies out, or is it more about pooling an approach?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, from a health perspective, everybody needs to get better for this to go away. So, I mean, in the event that you had one ally nation who was hoarding face N95 masks or ventilators, it doesn't really help them if another ally partner is not getting better. So I think as you saw the comfort level and the containment improved, you had, you know, people from France or Italy having treatment in Germany. And even outside of the traditional membership, you also had, you know, Poland was contributing supplies to Bosnia-Herzegovina. So, like I said, obviously this equipment was very in high demand, where they're going to have to come up with a better idea about how to get it all on the procurement level. And then when it comes to the strategic area about where you're getting it, obviously China was holding a lot of countries ransom on it. But I think now they're, you know, there's a lot more domestic homemade situation. So like I said, I think everybody across the board is going to be much better prepared for the second wave if it were to come in the fall.
Listening to an episode of Defense Deconstructed on the CGAI Podcast Network. These engaging conversations from the front lines of policy and politics are brought to you by the Canadian Association of Defense and Security Industries.
One thing that you had touched on in writing ahead of the summit was whether or not there'd be something about the 430s initiative that the alliance has. Was there something? And if not, what do you take away from that?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the major, major policy projects that was going on. It was supposed to demonstrate another example of rapid deployment, being able to sort of support an ally very quickly. So just for everybody out there, the 430s initiative is the deployment of 30 battalions, 30 battleships, and 30 air squadrons within 30 days or less. The target date for it was supposed to be ready by this year, 2020. But I mean, I think it seems inconceivable at this time, you know, due to the pandemic and existing barriers that hadn't been overcome, things like military mobility inside the Schengen, where you're talking more about this military style Schengen that hadn't happened. So there was no major developments on it. And I think that it's to be expected that this is a project that's still in development and in flux moving forward. So hopefully NATO will still be able to get it put together in the next 18 months.
Okay. So I think to me, some of the most important language that came out of the Secretary General's statement talked about a couple different aspects of nuclear deterrence and arms control going forward. Can you talk a little bit about what you saw coming out of that and what the takeaways are for allies?
Yeah, it seems Dave, like we're back in the Reagan-Gorbachev era. So just for everybody out there to situate it, you have basically three major arms treaties that have been the framework for reduction in arms control. You had the INF Treaty in 1987, you had Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty START in 1991, and then in 2002, you had the Strategic Offensive Reduction Treaty. Now, unfortunately, as you know, with the pullout of the INF, the whole dynamic in terms of arms control has been shattered, where they're going to have to rebuild it and see some new examples. But essentially, what came out of the ministerial is that Russia is back when it comes to arms control. They've been very loud about their extensive and ever-growing nuclear arsenal, which is also really important for everybody to realize because it's the Kremlin's one silver bullet to counter NATO's conventional superiority, where they're very, very reliant on it. So I think it's important for everybody just to realize that this is a major strategic issue now that dominated the conversation. And I think it's set to be a major issue moving forward for a long time.
And that's kind of the salience of that is getting driven because you've seen some weapon systems proliferation in particular, I guess, at least from the alliance perspective on the Russian side. I mean, there's a lot of conversation about that in a Canadian context with respect to NORAD, but I mean, it's the same systems irrespective of where they're deployed. And I noticed that the statement from the Secretary General had a lot of discussion about missile defense, not just kind of the big M, big D missile defense, but different types of systems and how effectively you could be positioned different allies to respond to them.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Secretary General is right to point out sort of this lingering threat that is very serious, as you spoke about. I mean, the pace of technological development is really happening at a neck-break pace, where Russia specifically is investing a huge amount in hypersonic missile systems and nuclear-powered missiles. Just for everybody out there, I think there's three specific examples that I just wanted to bring up, which is, you know, what's driving the conversation between NATO and its allies. So the Russians have been putting together these novel nuclear systems, and one that's been getting a lot of attention is the Avangard hypersonic glide vehicle system, which can carry a MIRV payload, multiple re-entry vehicle, can deliver both nuclear and conventional payloads, and it's just one of the six new strategic weapons being developed by Russia. There's the very famous Skyfall system, which has garnered a lot of attention, not because it was considered invincible by Vladimir Putin, but because there was a huge accident in August of 2019 in the Arkhangelsk Oblast, where five military specialists were killed. And then finally, Dave, you have this unarmed underwater drone test that's going to happen this year, Poseidon. So just based on those three systems and threats, I think it's great that NATO is really taking this seriously.
Right. And I guess that would be some fuel for sitting in Canada. There's a couple of different procurements that potentially could play roles there. So there's several different initiatives in the NORAD context, but we also do have different programs that are in the works to have a ground-based missile defense system. So on my quick read of the Secretary General's comments, that type of a project that Canada has, and presumably there's others and other allies, would be the kind of initiative that he's talking about different members of the alliance bringing forward in terms of an actual response.
Yeah, well, I mean, the playbook of the Russians, linking to what you're talking about, it values so much escalation domination on the ladder. And for instance, the last strategic nuclear force exercise Russia held, GROM, which is Russian for thunder, was held in October of last year. So there's a lot to take out of sort of the doctrine and policy when this exercise occurred, and then looking forward to see what will happen in the upcoming version or the most contemporary version of GROM in the future. So, I mean, arms control is back and NATO has a lot to do to step up to the plate to protect allies and, you know, offer this tangible and legitimate deterrence.
So as we're looking beyond just kind of the traditional sort of set of issues that the alliance deals with, certainly over the last year, and particularly at the there's a lot of discussion around the issue at the meetings in London back in before times, was about China and the relationship between the alliance and China. What did anything significant catch your eye in terms of how that dynamic and that relationship between China and that part of the world is going to evolve going forward?
Yeah, well, I mean, Secretary General Stoltenberg, he really didn't mince his word. He had an interview with Sonntag am Weltkrieg, with the German newspaper a week before, where he sort of made it very clear that China was coming to Europe and that NATO wasn't going to Asia. They've invested very heavily in military systems. It's a real threat. We're not even talking about 5G. But on the China issue, they have no appetite whatsoever to even consider the idea of arms control talks. Just for everybody out there, China has a 7-to-1 ratio of conventional to non-conventional weapons. So they're already very low nuclear stockpile compared to Russia and China. They have no appetite whatsoever to even put that onto the table. So, I mean, from the military side of it, China is definitely underscoring everything in addition to the traditional threat of Russia. And, you know, Dave, we haven't even talked about hybrid and lingering threat. One issue I would counsel the audience to look out for is I think you're going to be hearing a lot more about SNOWCAT, which is the support of NATO nuclear operations with conventional air tactics. Earlier in the week before the ministerial, Jessica Cox, director of nuclear policy at NATO, held an outstanding briefing, and she has an article in NATO Review where she outlined all of the issues. So it's a serious, serious issue. But the other issue that we can't overlook is that in addition to the military threat, you know, Russia is well-trained and well-versed in intimidation, and they've made it clear that any NATO member state hosting a nuclear component will be targeting. So it's also important for those NATO members who are part of this program to feel protected and that the deterrence will come to them in the event that an escalation or a conflict were to take place.
And I guess it's kind of timely to be having this conversation, just as you've seen reports today that Australia, and I was seeing that Australia did participate in the session along with a couple of other non-allies but partners with NATO, is facing a pretty significant cyber issue right now. So speaking more to the kind of the non-traditional, you know, nuclear conventional aspects of what the alliance does and the need for resilience, definitely seeing a lot of underscoring of the need to be better prepared in that respect.
Yeah, I mean, now more than ever, NATO really has to harness all of the advantages that come with its partnerships across the globe. You know, if you peer out to the international security landscape, it's a pretty intimidating and chaotic place to be looking at. Everything that's going on in Africa with terrorism that reaches all the way south is Mozambique. What's going on right now in Libya with Tripoli and the proxy war between Turkey and Russia is very concerning. You have the Middle East with what's going on still with Syria, as well as you mentioned earlier, in Asia. So I think the presence of the Australian Defense Minister on the 18th was a good idea. And I think it's going to become the norm where they're going to be meeting a lot more with more of their global partners to combat these threats.
So as you take the meetings this week and reflect forward, one of the things you hadn't had a chance to touch on yet is that there is an effort underway by the alliance to look ahead with the 2030 Reflection Group. Take your final thoughts in terms of what that, and drawing from what you're just saying about the other sets of issues that the alliance faces, where do you see that effort going, which actually has a Canadian contribution and participation in it?
Yeah, so everybody out there, a little bit while ago, Secretary General Stoltenberg announced the formation of this 2030 Reflection Group, which is really a great example of NATO trying to get its foresight in order and to really think and reimagine what security is going to look like in 10 years from now. It's a very impressive list of people. It's going to be co-chaired by the former German Defense Minister, Thomas de Maizière, and the former Undersecretary of State, Wes Mitchell. From Canada's side, we couldn't have gotten a better candidate in Greta Bolsonmeier, former Signet Chief and National Security Advisor to the Prime Minister. But going back to it in general, security is a concept that's living and it's in flux. So they're going to have to really reimagine what the real threats are going to look like in 10 years. And just one issue to not lose sight about when we're talking about China for issue is that it's not impossible that deterrence or pushing back against China might in 2 or 3 years evolve into one of these unifying issues. You see them with their strategic investments with the Belt and Road Initiative and the 17+1 investment format in Central and Eastern Europe, which, you know, it covers things like strategic ownership of ports and railways. So if they're going to have a good opportunity to really think about that, where I think the Canadian contribution, whether it might be in the Arctic or other areas, is sorely needed.
Well, Roger, really appreciate you coming on today to talk about what happened today while people here weren't necessarily paying attention. Last question, which may or may not be NATO to you, though, what are you reading?
Well, I'm actually reading David E. Hoffman's book, The Oligarchs, Wealth and Power in New Russia. So obviously this oligarch class gets a lot of attention today, but it's quite interesting to see the early foundations of them and their roots working in various ministries in the City Hall of Moscow and where they got to now, all of the power they wield in the halls of the Kremlin.
Okay. That sounds fascinating. If I had more time, I might dig into that. Thanks again. Appreciate you joining us today to chat about NATO. Stay safe.
Thanks a lot, Dave, and everybody out there as well. Practice social distancing.
Okay.
Ciao.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of Defense Deconstructed for the CGAI Podcast Network. Our guest this week was our fellow Roger Hill. If you like the show, please remember to rate us and leave a comment in your podcast app. And if you like our stuff, please feel free to check out our donation page at our website at cgai.ca/donate. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. The podcast is brought to you by our team in Ottawa, and thanks go to our producer, Jay Rankin, and Drew Phillips for providing our music. I'm Dave Perry, and thanks for listening to this episode of Defense Deconstructed.